signing out Lotus Notes, which arguably is just now getting designed in, via a technology called Microsoft Exchange, and designing out Oracle's database with a suite of products called BackOffice. Microsoft is partnering with every one of these vendors today, and these companies are willingly partnering with Microsoft. Why? It's the money. Partnering with Microsoft has made a lot of companies rich. The pervasiveness of its platforms creates an invaluable de facto standard for huge chunks of infrastructure. Moreover, companies the size of those mentioned also have plans for designing Microsoft out of the equation, and undoubtedly there will be successes on both sides. Having seen how some of the most successful companies in high tech have won during the tornado, we should also take a look now at how companies can lose as well. With all the wealth in play during a tornado, there is nothing more tragic than to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. But it has been done, and more than once. In defense of the companies cited below, most of their mistakes looked a lot more like good business tactics at the time. 1. Tornado forces are bigger than any one company's ability to control, so don't try. With VCRs being so ubiquitous today, it's hard to recall that a mere 15 years ago they were a novelty. By the time the VCR tornado got going, the market leader was Sony, and the dominant technology was Betamax. Today, however, there are no Betamax recorders. All consumer VCRs are VHS. How could this have happened? Sony tried to control the tornado. It refused to license its technology to other vendors, which meant not only that other VCR manufacturers were excluded from the market, but also that movie distributors had only one portal through which to pass to their customers. Sony's reasoning was this was their technology. They had invested in all the work to get the market to this point, so why should they share? The answer, as we now know, is the tornado must be served. When tornado demand hits, it far exceeds the initial supply. When a vendor acts in any way to further restrict supply, it is fighting the tornado, and the market will try to go around it, isolate it, and spit it out. That is what the other VCR manufacturers and the movie distributors did to Sony, albeit after some precarious years when video rental stores carried two types of recorder for rent and had two sections, beta and VHS, for tapes. During this time, Sony might have pulled itself back from the brink through licensing. That would not have gotten VHS out of the game, but it would have kept Sony in it. But Sony did not choose to do that. 2. Don't introduce discontinuity during a tornado. Whatever product architecture you take into a tornado, you must stick with for the duration, regardless of its limitations. The fundamental principle here is that continuous innovation favors market leaders, while discontinuous innovation favors market challengers. If you are in a tornado and winning, you want the market to stay continuous. Even if you are not in the gorilla position, if you are still profiting, you probably want it to stay continuous. Only if you are not winning and think you can win a future tornado should you opt for discontinuity. 3. Tornadoes design services out, not in. Perhaps the biggest casualty in the ongoing PC industry tornado has been the PC dealer channel, including such once high-flying companies as Computerland and Businessland. Each year of tornado volume further commoditized the PC solution set, designing out the need for the very expertise that these companies had made the mainstay of their businesses. The ability for this channel to earn the margins it needed from the services it knew how to provide was fatally undermined. The market now supports basically three kinds of customer contact institutions: superstores, which win the commoditization game; boutique value-added resellers, which win the high value-added service game by finding solutions for niche needs that have not yet succumbed to commoditization; and the traditional PC dealers, which have converted from inbound retail storefronts to outbound sales to business. All three have sustainable tornado positions. The one unsustainable position is to be an integrator of things that are perceived to have already been integrated. That is the strategy that fights the tornado. 4. Don't bet on preventing a tornado. In the latter part of the 1980s, the PC market was going through a crisis because, for the first time, the operating system standard was in jeopardy. Initially, everyone was sure the new standard was going to be OS 2. Later, it became increasingly likely it would be Windows. Having to develop for not one but two immature operating systems was putting enormous strains on the resources of the independent software vendors, and many, including Lotus and WordPerfect, opted to support OS 2 only. For a while, this was sound strategy. But as Windows' stature in the marketplace increased, neither company responded by shifting its development efforts. Ultimately, this led to giving Microsoft a 2-year advantage in the Windows application market for word processors and spreadsheets. This proved more than enough time for the company to snatch the gorilla status away in both categories, leaving WordPerfect helpless, hence its acquisition by Novell, and Lotus badly wounded. The winning strategy, assuming you have big company resources, is to distribute your bets at the beginning of any open systems contest, and then, over time, shift them away from losers toward the emerging winner. That is, as soon as you see one alternative lagging, kill it immediately, and reinvest that resource in one that is gaining. This strategy works because it's a lot easier in a tornado to see the losers than to pick the winner. You just continue this process of subtraction until there is only one project left. But at no time let yourself fall prey to wishing. Do not gamble. Just place your bets, take your losses and your winnings, and move on. Finally, if you do not have this kind of resource, if you cannot afford to back many horses at the same time, then this whole business is likely to be a non-issue. To be sure, by betting wrong, you will miss the tornado platform, but given your size going in, you are not likely to come out the gorilla anyway. Missing the tornado, therefore, is not a catastrophe for you. Indeed, it might be a benefit in disguise, since in a smaller pond, you may yet emerge a market leader. Bringing our discussion of the tornado to a close, the most important lesson is that the critical success factors for tornado strategy are diametrically opposed to those for the bowling alley. As a consequence, companies who have won great victories in the bowling alley and persist in their to-date successful mode of operation doom themselves to become second-tier players in the tornado and play increasingly marginalized roles as the market goes forward. Now we will incorporate the third and final inflection point in the technology adoption lifecycle, the transition from tornado to Main Street. When Dorothy steps out of the tornado into the land of Oz, she is remarkably accepting of her new fate. And after a brief interlude for adjustment, she sets right off down the yellow brick road. How admirably resourceful! If only our high-tech companies could show such pluck. Unfortunately, when they exit the tornado, they are usually in denial. And no wonder. The typical transition to Main Street begins catastrophically, displaying one or more of the following characteristics: dramatic shortfalls in projected revenues and profits, restatements of earnings that go back 1 or 2 years, massive exodus of the executives responsible, drastic downturns in stock price, and a shareholder lawsuit to be settled out of court, which further drains an already abused stock of capital. Welcome to Main Street. Your customers hate you. Your employees are burned out and demoralized. Your management team's greatest expertise is political infighting. Wall Street hasn't a clue, and your banker is on line one. And you were the winner. Let's get one thing straight right off. Tornadoes do not end any faster than they start. There are always plenty of warnings. The problem is that we ignore them all. We just keep the pedal to the metal And the results are, well, bloody. Why do we do this? As with many ill-considered actions, it's because it seems like the right thing to do at the time. Consider the context. For the past 4 years or so, we have been part of an organization that has been growing at 100% or more per year. Without any additional stimulation effort on our part, market demand is screaming, and we in turn are whipping ourselves to outsell and outship the competition. So when the first signs of a slowdown begin to emerge, you bash right through them. For a while, this approach works a lot better than one might expect. There is normally enough slack in any market to reward a do-or-die effort once or even twice. But then the signals start getting stronger, to the point where even we can see them. But how do we get off this carousel? And who is going to blink first? The problem now, with all our macho slogans still ringing in our ears, is that there's no way we can retreat and save face. So we blast ahead anyway. This is bad enough, but it gets worse. Future commitments get scored as current revenues. Sales into indirect channels, which are still subject to returns, get booked as if they were already sold through. Questionable accounting practices is what this is sometimes called. And now, of course, we are not just trying to save face with our colleagues, we are trying to save stock price on Wall Street, which is, of course, a losing battle. Wall Street has pegged us as a hypergrowth stock, which has shot our valuation way up. Now, hypergrowth is stopping. The tornado is ending. There is nothing we can do about that. So, of course, our valuation must go down. Trying to keep it artificially up is a losing game. The best you can do is postpone the inevitable, each time at the cost of making the eventual crash that much more catastrophic. Sooner or later, then, all this catches up with us. And when it does, resignations must and do follow in Watergate fashion, with everyone trying to stonewall all along the way. Eventually, to be sure, the bloodshed stops. Eventually, people start picking up the pieces, and the high-tech enterprise is able to wean itself from the drug of hypergrowth, substituting instead the sort of business disciplines that are routine in other industries. But it does so with its head cast down, and at the first sign of a new tornado, it is off and running again. Main Street markets begin when the waves of frantic infrastructure replacement begin to subside and the new paradigm begins to settle in. Consumption of the core commodity continues at a prodigious rate, but now supply has once again got ahead of demand. With supply exceeding demand, buying power returns to the customer, and vendors must once again compete for their business. To serve these customers, vendors must develop a whole series of low-cost disciplines, which will have the following salutary effects. 1. It will expand their unit market share, creating more customers for life. And 2. It will increase their profitability on higher margin sales. That being said, vendors also need to get margin relief from some form of value-based pricing. This in turn means gaining sponsorship for value from someone in the buying organization. We should note that as we move on to Main Street, our two previous sponsors for value-based pricing have both withdrawn their interest. The pragmatist economic buyers, who sponsored us in our bowling alley days, have long since directed their attentions elsewhere because the infrastructure rollout has resolved their problems. And the IT community, which sponsored value-based pricing during the tornado to ensure quality underpinnings to the infrastructure it was anxious to deploy, finally has things back under control and is also focused elsewhere. Now that these two groups have removed themselves from the field, we must find a new sponsor, someone else who will assign value to our differentiation. It is in this context that we focus our attention, really for the first time, on the end user. They are the ones who define the lucrative niche markets on Main Street, the added value extensions that live at the periphery of the core commodity infrastructure. Prior to Main Street, end users have only a secondary voice in high-tech purchase decisions. The special issues of the economic buyer and the infrastructure buyer taking precedence. But now that those issues have been resolved, end users can come into prominence. What they want is personal satisfaction from using the product, be it in the form of greater productivity, enhanced enjoyment, or reduced pain. This holds true regardless of whether the product is a business or a consumer purchase, the question being in the latter case whether they can afford it, in the former case whether they can get their boss to pay for it. In either case, this desire for personal satisfaction from a vendor perspective creates the ground for a value-based competition based on differentiated offerings. Such ground is critical to stake out and develop if the vendor is to get any relief from the margin pressure of low-cost commodity procurements. The goal of end-user marketing, then, is to leverage their preferences into higher margin returns. The fundamental lesson of Main Street, the one which we deny, is that it does not need more advanced high-tech solutions. It needs more accommodating ones. This in turn implies a whole new set of disciplines with which our sector is unfamiliar. These disciplines, well known from other industries, must be redefined for use in high tech, a task our industry is just now undertaking. The defining characteristic of Main Street is that continued profitable market growth can no longer come from selling the basic commodity to new customers and must instead come from developing niche-specific extensions to the base platform for existing customers. The end users want these extensions, but how are they going to pay for them? It turns out they don't have to. They're free. Okay, maybe not exactly free, but they certainly seem to be, for as the price performance of high-tech continues to improve, the product that customers purchased 2 or 3 years ago now costs much less when bought today. But customers still build their budgets on the assumption that product prices are going to stay the same, or perhaps increase a little. As a result, whether as a business customer or as a consumer, they have allocated more funds to the next purchase than are required and are pleasantly surprised to find some left over. Now, the job of purchasing agents is to get those leftover funds back. And left to their own devices, they will. But the job of vendors is to attract end users into spending those free dollars instead on added value extensions that appeal to them. To do that, we need to give them the right kind of offer, what we have ended up calling the whole product plus one. The idea behind plus one extensions to the whole product is to leverage the commoditized whole product created in the tornado, creating differentiation through secondary characteristics rather than through driving up its primary performance vectors. The latter is happening too, of course, but increasingly it is being taken for granted and is unable to generate the needed profit margins. These secondary characteristics, on the other hand, are rooted as much in the subjective experience of the end user as they are in any objective change to the product itself, and represent an unexploited opportunity to create perceived added value. The goal is to win the sponsorship of a specific category of end users, justifying a higher price based not on a higher cost, but rather on a higher value received. This set of tactics is so foreign to engineering mentality as to be virtually paralyzing to high-tech companies. Marketing, in the engineering universe, is that place where the laws of utility are suspended. Engineers are of two minds about this. On the one hand, if painting the product red sells more product, by all means paint it red. On the other hand, Since there is no rational cause operating here, you cannot trust marketing, as anyone can see for themselves, since sometimes, when they paint it red, it does not sell more. So marketing is essentially voodoo. It is not a real discipline. And that is when engineering is being nice. Now, this has been the source of much high-tech humor and joshing back and forth between the two groups. But in fact, it represents a life-threatening disability when it comes to Main Street success. Because on Main Street, continued high profit margins can only come from end users sponsoring our product over the low-cost clone. And the only thing that will get them to do that is to deliver them subjective experiences of the product that fulfill their needs. That means engineering must learn to authentically empower marketing. The goal here is to permit R&D to let go of controlling the company's invention process. Not everywhere in the life cycle, to be sure, but when on Main Street. If we can really get the ball served into marketing's court, then it can be marketing, rooting its processes in customer interaction and communication, that can come to R&D with product ideas, and not the other way around. A company like Intuit, with its product Quicken, has captured the attention of our industry precisely because of its ability to do just this. In part, as a legacy of its chairman Scott Cook's stint at Procter & Gamble, Intuit has repeatedly demonstrated the kind of customer-focused market learning, experimentation, and research necessary to drive this kind of innovation. Now it's time for the rest of the industry to catch up. To do that, we need some new tools, the most important of which will help us rediscover just who end users really are and what they really want. The basic discipline for Main Street marketing is make an offer, learn from it, correct your mistakes, make another offer. This is the opposite of the deliberate, careful approach used in the bowling alley, where an offer involves coordinating a substantial amount of investment, including a series of partnership relationships, and risking one's reputation in the process. On Main Street, offers are much lighter. They can be pulled together faster, they typically involve no more than one partner, and if they fail, the market normally just ignores them. So one can use offers much more aggressively, and many companies do. Where companies fall down in many cases is that they neglect to think of this activity as a research mode, as test marketing. Instead, they think of it as a product-moving promotion, and thus fail to build learning into the offer mechanism. This is close to criminal. Most high-tech offers, particularly in the retail end of the business, require some additional processing to fulfill them. Once the customer has entered this process, but before the offer has been fulfilled, there is a window of data collection opportunity. This is the time and place to learn about niches. During the fulfillment portion of the purchase process, in other words, you have a live customer on the other end of the line. No other research point can so reliably qualify a respondent. If you make contact before this moment, you are never sure you are listening to a true buyer. And if you wait until after the offer is fulfilled, there's always a chance you're getting a biased sample, say people who respond to surveys of their own free will, or people who file customer registration cards, which, incidentally, typically eliminates most Fortune 500 customers. But if you collect data during the purchase, then you have your hands on something special. To really get into the subtleties of a customer's reason to buy, their niche needs, and the demographics and psychographics that go along with them, requires a carefully scripted additional effort. If you realize, however, that this data's value may well exceed the value of the profit margin on the product being sold, you will plan to offer your customer a special award for giving it to you. For example, you might say, if you can take the time to answer a few additional questions, we'd like to send you this valuable free offer. Such are the underlying mechanics behind what is sometimes called the ready, fire, aim approach to niche identification. The point of going into these kinds of tactics is to make one point absolutely clear. Ignorance of target customer niches is no excuse for not immediately pursuing a niche-based marketing program on Main Street. If you don't have a clear target customer in mind, make one up, put something out there, and see what happens. Neither the risks nor the resources required are sufficient to deter you from diving directly into the marketplace, and the reward of finding a profitable niche is more than adequate recompense for the temporary setback and embarrassment of having a first offer resoundingly rejected. To create higher profit margins for Main Street, we need to have a source of new offers that has virtually no cost. Where can we get our hands on such a source? The answer is, it's already in the product. Consider all the menu items on your favorite software program, all the buttons on the remote control for your TV, or the ones on the front of your telephone. Do you know what every one of them does? Okay, maybe you do, but nobody else does. So what does that mean? It means that R&D dollars have been put into these products that customers have never gotten out. The key point here is a simple one. Until a product's feature is used, it has no value. What Main Street marketing allows customers to do is to catch up on the value that is latent inside the high-tech product line, but that had to be suppressed in order not to confuse people during the rush to deploy the new infrastructure. Now that things have settled down, they can have a chance to experience this value, but only if we teach them to. That is the function of Plus One Marketing. It focuses on one or more of these features, finds out who might really like it, and figures out why it is not being used today. Then it invests whatever Plus One R&D is needed to remove the obstacles and repackages the offering targeted at a specific niche of customers touting the new Plus One capability. By so doing, everyone wins. Everyone, that is, except the purchasing agent. The end user gets more value. The economic buyer does not go over budget. The technical buyer still gets standard reliable infrastructure, and the vendor gets higher margins. Plus One Market Research, then, is a joint enterprise between R&D and marketing, the former helping to surface the latent potential still unreleased in the product, the latter seeking out niches of people who might value that potential if it were repackaged to be more accessible to them. Once a good match has been found, then the goal is to deliver to that niche. The goal on Main Street is to maximize the financial yield from your installed base. You have captured your territory. Now it is time to till it, and the company with the highest yield per acre is the victor. Working against us are purchasing agents who continue to foster competitive warfare to serve their interest in driving bids lower. In their view, the reference competitor is not the market leader's product, but the clone. For example, when PCs were in the tornado, first IBM and then Compaq set the reference price. Everyone else had to discount below them in order to get sales. But once PCs moved onto Main Street, it was Dell and Gateway and Zeos that were setting the reference price, and IBM and Compaq were put on the defensive to justify their higher prices. As the risk of getting an incompatible system declines, the value the market assigns to the market leader decreases. The de facto standard is in place, so getting some off-brand is not as big a risk, and hence the clone requires less of a discount to get the sale. There is still some value in a leading brand, but it is much decreased. Now instead you must earn margins by showing how your Plus One programs add value above the commodity. In terms of competition, then, Plus One programs do not compete against other Plus One programs as much as they do against the low-cost core commodity. The goal is to distinguish an otherwise undifferentiated offering, garnering a modest premium for niche-specific added value. This approach to competition, in turn, implies a light touch with positioning. The plus one rewards are normally not great enough to warrant massive communication campaigns. Instead, they are designed to capitalize on a purchase process that is already well-oiled. This means more and more of the communications should be targeted closer and closer to the moment of purchase, where the process can be redirected at the last moment to a more profitable end. Merchandising, therefore, normally takes precedence over advertising. And where salespeople are present, training should focus not on how to educate the customer, but on how to sell up from the established low-cost solution or down from the high-priced premium offer. So there is much to be excited about in the Main Street world. And the primary goal of high-tech companies should be to convert their approach to marketing in order to leverage these rewards. But all of this must still be advocated with the caveat that the underlying dynamics of high-tech do not let you settle down on Main Street. Because regardless of how sophisticated your systems are today, regardless of how high the barriers to entry surrounding your Garden of Eden, if the weeds outside are growing at the rate of an order of magnitude every 3.5 years, they will invade and take over sooner or later. The question is, what are you going to do about it? The only right answer here is to become a weed too and take over your own garden. The key point is that high-tech companies should welcome, not resist, the transition to Main Street, seeing it as an opportunity to settle into some profitable niche marketing, at least until the next tornado comes along. Main Street success factors run counter to the lessons of the tornado, much as the key success factors for the tornado ran counter to the lessons of the bowling alley. Disturbing as this is, there is simply nothing we can do to change it. What we can do, however, is recognize that all this switching among contradictory states is bound to cause some confusion. In particular, it will be easy for some people to think we are in one stage of the market, while others think we are in another. If this is allowed to persist, people will be working at cross purposes, violently. Therefore, it is critical that teams responsible for charting marketing strategy agree on where they are in the technology adoption lifecycle before they set about formulating any plan of action. How to go about establishing that agreement is the next subject. The first step to establishing your place in the life cycle is to realize that it is not your product per se, but rather the category of product as a whole that the market positions. Let's take the example of Hewlett-Packard's 200LX, a pocket-sized palm-top PC that comes with Lotus 1-2-3, several calculators, a complete suite of personal information management software, and clever interfaces to email, including a fully portable radio mail unit. Where is that on the life cycle? Well, the first question we must answer is, what is the 200LX? If it is a portable digital assistant, or PDA, it is in the chasm. Obvious enough if you are Apple, Sony, or Motorola, and have shipped few of your still awkwardly performing pen-based units, but not so obvious if you are HP and have shipped three generations of product at reasonable volumes with no pen involved. But that is where the category is, and therefore that is where every member of the category must be. On the other hand, if we take a different category of product as a reference point, say electronic organizers, which are clearly on Main Street as the millions of units that Sharp and Casio have shipped prove, then the HP product isn't a pen-lacking PDA caught in the chasm, but rather an overpriced electronic organizer languishing on Main Street. That's where it would be if it is in that category, despite all its whizzy new tech features. But wait, says someone else, it's both. To which the only answer is, no, it is not. You cannot market something that violates the categorical scheme of the marketplace that must support it. Stores won't know in what department to sell it, and consumers won't know where to go to buy it, and no one will know with which products to compare it to determine if it has a fair price. In 1994, HP chose to be in the PDA market, which I think was a good choice, since that market has a future, has no established leaders, and is more consistent with the 200LX's underlying technological strengths. However, the 200LX's shipment rates confused HP into thinking it was closer to the Tornado than it really was. Advertising for the product was Tornado-oriented, positioning it as a product for a general mass of people who call themselves road warriors. This was too big a jump, too soon. Something easy to see if you say we are in the chasm, not so easy if you think we are already in the bowling alley, which of course was HP's view. The point in all this is that significant marketing expenditure and risk ultimately hinge on a choice about where the product is in the technology adoption life cycle. In most tough calls, the ambiguity comes from a mixing of a Main Street category with some element of discontinuous innovation. The question being, how much total discontinuity will be experienced in the marketplace, and thus, where will this fit on the life cycle? There are two kinds of discontinuity that shape the technology adoption life cycle. The first is paradigm shock, whether experienced by end users or the infrastructure that supports them. An electric car, for example, will give both constituencies a bad time, since mechanics, gas stations, owners, and even the corporations that employ these owners will all have to learn new ideas, make new investments, and adopt new behaviors. Electric cars, then, represent a high level of paradigm shock. Notebook computers, on the other hand, represent a fairly low level. One does have to learn more about batteries than one ever wanted to know, and this may well entail an additional investment in a portable battery recharger. And if one gets into the business of sending faxes from one's hotel room, the paradigm shock meter can jump quite a bit. But if all you want to do is write on airplanes, then using a notebook is pretty close to using a desktop. You probably will have to master a trackball as opposed to a mouse, since there's no room for a mouse on the tray table in front of you. But other than that, it's the same software, same keyboard, same deal. The other dimension of discontinuity is application breakthrough, the result of dramatic changes in end-user roles enabled by the new technology, which in turn spur equally dramatic returns on investment. When voice recognition units supplant customer service operators, there's a paradigm shock for the callers, but a phenomenal savings to organizations like newspapers, movie theaters, and airlines, all of whom have a high volume of routine calls to process. Dramatic improvements in end-user capabilities, then, are the accelerator that drives technology adoption, just as paradigm shock is the brake. There also exists cultural or psychological shock, where the barrier is not objective but subjective. But this, too, is part of paradigm shock. Consider the following pair of cases. Color printers put very little technological stress on the infrastructure. They work just like black and white printers, only with different color ink cartridges. Whatever paradigm shock there is, it is at the end user level, not the technical support persons. Moreover, color in business is well accepted as a niche application in the hands of trained graphic artists, but not as general purpose infrastructure for the rest of us, the graphically challenged. Here, end users are nervous about making fools of themselves. They recall what they did when they first got fonts. And economic buyers are even more nervous about lost productivity as users fiddled to get just the right shade of fuchsia for their upcoming presentation to top management. So we are stuck in the bowling alley with the unnerving thought that we might be here forever. Now, what is actually happening is that color-enabled printers are so inexpensive they are proliferating anyway. People are just not using the color very much. This is fine if you are in the razor business of making printers. It is not so good if you are in the razor blade business of making ink cartridges. If the average user buys, say, 4 cartridges a year at $25 per cartridge, that is $100 million in revenue for every million printers in service. It is not hard to see how this can be a multi-billion dollar market, with color cartridges having premium pricing. So if you make these supplies, gaining general adoption of color is critical. The need, then, is for a late bowling alley strategy that breaks out of the graphics ghetto and into the mainstream. One proposed strategy is to start a new alley, away from graphics, focusing on using color to illustrate data. Color graphs instead of graphics is the focus of this campaign, the message being that people can see the patterns in the data far better if they are shown in color. Target customers include anyone who makes heavy use of spreadsheet graphs in reports or presentations. Finance professionals, market researchers, strategic planners, quality control managers, and the like. Alternatively, another target could be service providers, such as insurance companies, who pitch big-ticket items like HMO or benefit packages, and find that their proposal document must carry a significant part of the selling load. Both groups have a compelling reason to buy, although the latter may have the edge for getting scarce funds. In any case, there is no problem finding valid target customers. The issue is whole product. Specifically, the traditional showstopper to broader office use has been the absence of an affordable color copier. Color-based data and proposals don't just lose their charm in black and white, they lose information. But with the increasing speed of even low-cost printers, we will soon have a new option called print your copies. This way, a single professional will be able to control the production process end-to-end, something that is critical for both ad hoc business reporting and proposal generation. Print your copies, however, replaces one paradigm shock with another. One copies copies. One doesn't print them. It is a cultural paradigm, and it is about to take on tornado significance globally as the print and the copy paradigms are on a collision course. Both industries have known for some time that, with lower and lower cost digitization available, their underlying technologies have been converging. Now, going forward, they are virtually identical. The paradigm shock, as we have seen, will be at the end user level. People see copiers and printers as coming from completely different worlds, the former historically under the purview of administrative services, the latter computer services. From a workflow point of view, we print once and copy many. We think printing many is weird. We also think scanning is weird, even though that is precisely what a copier does. So that while a printer with a color scanner is in fact a direct substitute for a color copier, our psychology simply has not yet caught up to the underlying technological convergence. Now, given all of the above, where does a printer copier fit on the life cycle? One's natural inclination is to put it in Main Street, as each side makes continuous improvements to existing technology serving existing workflows. But that would be a grave mistake. In fact, the psychological discontinuity drives it all the way back to the beginning of the life cycle, because we simply cannot imagine the application breakthrough, even though it is already enabled. As a result, the only way back home to Main Street is to go around the horn, first by focusing on workflow breakthroughs to engage visionary adoption, then gaining pragmatist acceptance, and then accelerating back to Main Street. This journey should take much less time than a genuine adoption life cycle, because it is essentially psychological, not technological, but it must follow the same curve. The discontinuity analysis we have been conducting is based on applying a theoretical predictive model to the marketplace. One can also take an empirical approach to the problem, working backward from the marketplace's actual behavior to date. Here you look for characteristic elements that signal life cycle status. One such element is the press. Here are excerpts from two front-page articles in the same issue of PC Week, dated December 27, 1993, each followed with some commentary on lifecycle positioning. First, WinPad-based mobile computers due from hardware vendors in June. The first WinPad devices will run on release 1.0 of WinPad, a 16-bit standard mode Windows derivative tailored for handheld systems, according to developers briefed on Microsoft's plans. Microsoft officials declined to comment on specific plans for WinPad. WinPad's user interface will feature a table of contents, tabs, drag icons, a zoom-in lens, and a tray-like clipboard, sources said. One sure signal of an early market product is when its own developer declines to comment on it. Another is when the coverage focuses on the technology and product features, the two items of greatest interest to early market players. By contrast, mainstream markets are more interested in market and company information. Compare this pre-chasm positioning of WinPad to the following PC Week article about Lotus Notes, remembering this is in December of 1993. Notes administrators move slowly on enterprise-wide migration path. Network administrators and application developers are finding several hurdles on their path toward migrating Lotus Development Corp's Notes from the department to the enterprise. Although users are generally pleased with Notes 3.0, corporate customers are finding it tough to develop robust enterprise-wide applications that can be used throughout companies. Although Lotus officials tout the concept of living in Notes, in reality, most of the 500,000 install base of users are, at the moment, just visiting. Quote, Notes not being available on Unix is a major concern to us, says Kevin Dehany, manager, Workgroup Applications Development, Millipore Corporation. Second quote, We need better database connectivity. Especially a good link from Notes to our large corporate databases on DP2, end quote, says John Murphy, Director of Telecommunications at Travelers Corp. Now, what we see here is a gradual migration to mainstream concerns. Note how much the article talks about people instead of product. The product has crossed the chasm, as indicated by the phrase, migrating from the department to the enterprise, and also by the phrase, users are generally pleased. Yet it is not quite ready for prime time, as indicated by the recurrent use of although. Overall, the feeling is that users want a tornado, but the IT people are saying that the whole product cannot stand up to a tornado-class infrastructure deployment. As a result, we would conclude Notes is in the bowling alley by default, although there is no indication of niche marketing. Instead, there is an uneasy balance of tornado demand and near-chasm-like deficiencies in the whole product. Beyond press coverage, a second source of clues to market status comes from the behavior of other companies in the infrastructure. Lou Platt at HP, for example, realized that their commercial Unix server business was in the tornado when software vendors were calling him rather than the other way around. Going further, when a tornado is underway, the easiest way to spot the gorilla is to look for the company whose platform is first choice for other companies to support. If there's a lot of supporting activity focused on a single vendor, even if that vendor is not you, it is a good sign that you and they are in a tornado market. A second sign from the infrastructure is cloning. Most companies will not bother to emulate a product unless it is in the tornado and is the gorilla. There simply is not enough demand to warrant this behavior at other times in the market. This cloning goes hand in hand with a third type of tornado warning from the infrastructure, widespread price discounting within the product category, both for the gorilla product, as a lost leader to get customers into the store, and for clone products, to get the lowest possible price. Whether or not you get your position relative to the life cycle absolutely correct, the critical success factor for any team is to come to a unanimous consensus and then act on that basis. If you all row in the same direction, it is much easier to course correct as you go along. The following are some helpful hints to keep your group on target. 1. Just because a product has not yet been shipped doesn't mean it is in the early market. Instead, it should be placed where the group thinks it will enter the life cycle when it does ship. Every new generation of DRAM, for example, goes straight into the tornado. 2. The same product can be at different points in the life cycle depending on global context. Typically, the markets in Japan, the United States, and Germany are not in sync with each other. So specify geography when making a group choice. 3. You can get to Main Street without ever going through a tornado. Sometimes we call these products bowling alley forever. They just never become generic infrastructure. But their markets do mature, and the whole product does eventually become a commodity within the niches they serve. When it is clear to you that there is little chance of any tornado in the future, marketing should refocus itself to take a Main Street plus one approach. 4. Just because your product is going down the tubes doesn't mean you're in the chasm. Products can fail anywhere in the life cycle, although failing in a tornado does take special work. Finally, 5, as already noted, you can have a local tornado within a single bowling alley segment. Demand exceeding supply will create tornado-like effects on your staff, but will not generate tornado returns to your shareholders. Treat this instead as a bowling pin market at its hottest. How do you predict when a tornado will start? I don't suppose I can leave this section without at least addressing this question, because it is the one most on people's lips once they get into working with the life cycle model. On the other hand, I trust no one believes I can actually answer it. If I could, why would I not be firmly ensconced, pina colada in hand, gazing out into the Pacific blue, eyes beginning to flutter as the morning nap approaches? That being said, however, we can at least frame the problem as follows. First, bowling alley successes help tornadoes to start because they validate product architectures, albeit within limited circumstances. Without any such successes, the tornado wants to happen but has trouble getting off the ground. There are simply too many de facto standards that have yet to emerge. So one sign of tornado readiness is some niche market successes in place. Second, in retail markets, price point is a key indicator of tornado readiness. As a rule of thumb, getting under $1,500 gets one into the small office market, where getting under $1,000 enables a tornado. Similarly, getting under $700 gets one into the home market, and getting under $300 enables a tornado. These are not fixed laws, of course, but when it comes to prediction, nothing is. More abstractly, tornadoes require commoditization of the whole product. As long as there is even one significant component that requires scarce expertise to integrate, the market will struggle to get into the tornado phase. Conversely, once the last element is removed, if the market is ever going to tornado, it should happen almost immediately. If markets do not tornado under these circumstances, it usually means there is no killer application, no compelling reason to buy. The big signal for the tornado is the killer app. But it is not clear to me if tornadoes cause killer apps or vice versa. What we can say about these applications is that they supply universal infrastructure, are appealing to a mass market, and are commoditizable. You can know that a tornado has started when a guerrilla company begins to emerge. By that point, however, it is normally too late to change history. And finally, betting on the tornado coming at a specific time is like buying a lottery ticket and expecting to win. There are simply too many variables to make this kind of bet make sense. We've been exploring the impact of market forces traceable to the technology adoption lifecycle, and we've discussed in broad terms the course of action appropriate at each stage. All told, this has been an exercise in navigation, of building a map of the lifecycle and learning how to read it properly. Our last act in this sequence has been to see how we could use the discontinuity model and the life cycle model as a kind of sextant or navigational aid. Now we are going to integrate these ideas with the following traditional business strategy concerns: strategic partnerships, competitive advantage, positioning, and organizational leadership. What all these concerns share is a common interest in power and its distribution within marketplaces at large and within individual companies. When, as we move through a life cycle, critical success factors change, the power of different people and institutions rises and falls as well. As long as life cycles are relatively long-lived, our current market and managerial institutions are able to absorb these changes. However, in the realm of high tech, and increasingly spreading to other high change sectors as well, they can no longer do so. Life cycles are evolving too quickly, and there are too many of them. Power is changing hands far too often, and our traditional market mechanisms and management systems are not able to keep up with it. This is creating disillusion about strategic partnerships, confusion about sustainable competitive advantage, disorientation as to positioning, and resentment among our line organizations. The way forward requires some drastic rethinking about how fundamental power relationships are defined and maintained in a rapidly shifting marketplace. Partnerships, under the pressure of the evolution of the whole product, inevitably get into cross-purposes, and the only way to manage them going forward is to surface the real issues. Ultimately, those issues revolve around a single central concern: power. In order to manage and communicate effectively, and in order to set strategy realistically, we need to have a public model of how partner power is appropriately distributed within a market. As with everything else, these power relationships will shift as the life cycle unfolds. In the early market, power lies with the technology provider and the systems integrator. The former has the bait that brings visionary customers into range. The latter has the tackle necessary to land them. Next to the technology provider and the integrator, everyone else is a bystander, to be brought into the game at the call of the integrator. The reason why bystanders take an interest at this point is that visionary deals often drag along very large purchases of complementary infrastructure products and services. If these bystanders are market leaders in their own right, integrators acknowledge that power cautiously, seeking to co-opt their good standing with the customer without ceding account control. On the other hand, if bystanders are simply commodity suppliers, integrators expect and get them to jump at a moment's notice. In the bowling alley, as well as when crossing the chasm, power centralizes into the hands of the ringleader of the niche market attack. This is the company that has scoped out the target customer, understood the compelling reason to buy, and designed the whole product. These people see the market opportunity. Nobody else does. In effect, then, they are recruiting partners for a mining expedition. They are the ones with the map to the gold, and that is what gives them their power. The key to making these partnerships work, then, is leadership based on the ringleader's knowledge of the marketing opportunity. Conversely, it is not based on them having the image of being a much larger company. I stress this because many small companies feel they need the latter in order to gain the support of powerful allies. It simply isn't true. There is a curious form of symbiosis at work here as follows. Small companies' bowling pins can be large companies' plus one extensions. Large corporations need these niche expansions to grow their Main Street businesses, but their management mechanisms make it hard to champion these efforts from within the company. The initial revenue results simply look too paltry to bother with. They are still suffering from post-tornado syndrome, where anything less than another home run seems not worth the bother. When an energetic outsider comes in with a clear target and a good plan, it fills this leadership vacuum. Dragging the Main Street company into new areas of opportunity it cannot get to under its own power. The key to success here is to have early wins that escalate. Large vendors have short attention spans and many people competing for their attention, but nothing cuts through that clutter like success. In short, the focus of the leader's efforts must be to make sure that each partner in the alliance makes money, particularly in the first few engagements. This money primes the pump for the partnership. Once the pump is running, it will feed itself, and the ringleader can sit back and reap the profits. Power in the tornado centralizes in guerrilla companies and their cronies, what we might call the club. Nominees for this roster are set by the contents of the whole product inventory, from which the market selects a leading candidate for each component. This slate of candidates is elected as the institutionalized solution set within which every component is guaranteed to be compatible with every other. Customers can always swap out component vendors from this set, and most sooner or later do, but they do so at their own risk. Surrounding this club of gorillas is a horde of monkeys running in and out, trying to play on inter-guerrilla rivalries to gain opportunistic business. The temptation is to say that these monkeys have no power, and that is true if you look at any one of them individually.